Before proving the convergence, let us consider the iterative scheme. Which is, as in the general case, U iterate equal to G computed in the old iterate. So previous iterate, the inverse of the Jacobian matrix computed in the previous iterate multiplied by this vector. Just notice the analogy with the tangent or Newton method in the scalar case. In the scalar case, you would have the iterate, old iterate, minus in scalar case I have only one derivative, the function over the index is in the upper position, the function over the derivative, as you know. Here the scenery is more complicated due to the presence of this explicit inverse. You know that if it is possible, explicit computation of inverses should be avoided. I can fix this by multiplying on both sides by the matrix, the Jacobian matrix itself, and before I carry the previous iterate at the left hand side, so I find the equivalent relation Jacobian matrix difference between the new and the old one equal to what is left at the right hand side minus fx super I. So I see here that I have a linear system . What does this mean? At each step of the Newton-Raphson iteration I have to solve a linear system having as coefficient matrix the Jacobian computed in the old iterate. So generally, a step of this method, the cost per step is, in the general case, cubic due to the solution of this linear system. Well, let us turn to the convergence matter. The first result is not very complicated to prove. Let us start from the analysis of the value of H in alpha. First point of the proof. H in alpha, before substituting alpha, let us consider H of a generic X. The entries of this matrix are the partial derivatives of G. Let me use the same indices as here. H of X with indices R and T, which means the partial derivative of GR with respect to XT computed in X. Who is GR? GR of X is the corresponding component of the unit rate of G of X. That is X with the same index minus here I have in the vector form the product of the inverse of X by Fx. So here I must write the entry component of index R of that vector. This is a row by column vector. If for the sake of simplicity I call the inverse of J with K, capital letter, K of X, here I must write row by column. Which row? The row R of this matrix, K lowercase R, a column index, say S, of X, the entries of this matrix are all functions of X by column F S of X. This is the explicit expression of GR computed in X. I have to derive this with respect to X sub T. The usual rules of derivation, the relation of the difference of the derivatives, the GR, the XT, X. The derivative of this minus the sum, the derivative of the sum of the derivative, the derivative of these products, either first, the first factor, multiplied by the second factor plus the first factor by the derivative of I close the bracket. The sum is as before over the index S. Now the first term, the second side, the left hand side, it is simple to manage, because this derivative is 1 if the indices are equal and is 0 if the indices are different. So in this case, it is simple to use the special symbol, the delta of Kronecker delta, in the same indices, which is a compact way to mean 1 when R and T are equal, otherwise. The left two terms, let us give a look to the second sum. We immediately realized that here a sum, row by column
of which row?
The row of index R of K, the matrix K, which is the inverse of the Jacobian J, multiplied by, this is the column of index T, of J itself. Elementi che stanno sull'inversa di J, elementi che stanno su J e che stanno al posto giusto. These are lie on the row of index R, this lie on the column of index T. Inverse by the matrix itself. So this product makes the identity matrix. So if you consider the sum, as I said before, let us split the sum into the second sum is again one when the two indices are the T are equal and zero if the two indices are distinct, are different. But here there is also a minus sign. So we have the Kronecker delta minus the Kronecker delta. This term is, I don't write it again, with the sign. Minus the Kronecker delta RT. So they cancel, and the conclusion is that I write here the final result for this partial derivative is minus. This expression, the expression there above, involving the inverse, the antithesis of the inverse K minus the sum of S, the derivatives of the inverse K here I have this. If you replace x with alpha, the generic derivative in alpha is equal, let me substitute directly here, alpha is solution of the assigned linear system. So all the f, all the functions f sub s, are zero valued in alpha. So all this is zero, which means h in alpha is the zero matrix, which is what we wanted to prove. So convergence is assured, is guaranteed. The spectral radius is zero, which is less than one. So we have local convergence. Under general assumptions, the Newton-Raphson method locally converges, we may say, always. Have not local convergence only in pathological cases. The second aspect, which is worthwhile to inspect, is the quadratic convergence. The quadratic convergence can be stated in various ways. We will prove only that we do not, we will not define a measure of convergence speed or rate of convergence as the, it can be done, as you probably remember from the scalar case. We will prove for the quadratic convergence simply that the error at step I plus one, I mean any norm we have no prescriptions on the choice of the norm is less or equal to, less than or equal to a constant beta, which depends also on the choice of the norm, multiplied by the square of the norm of the previous error. The quadratic rate of convergence is shown by the exponent 2, which appears here. The proof. There is some algebraic trick to show this. We start from a manipulation of the iterative scheme. We write, we start from the iterative scheme. I write it again. Previous minus the inverse by F. Then let us add alpha. I write here and here on both sides. Plus or minus? Minus. Sorry. Why? Because we want to see the error in some place of our expressions. Then let us multiply all by J. J and X I by X nu minus alpha, and also here J X by the old iterate minus alpha, minus here the inverse disappears, minus F. Now let us treat in some way the second manner. In which way? By using the Taylor formula for F. Well, Taylor formula applied to F in the neighborhood of the solution alpha. What says? Says that F in alpha is null vector, zero vector, F in alpha, we expand, not in the neighborhood of alpha, we expand F in alpha in the neighborhood of F computed in the old iterate. constant term, first order term of the Taylor formula, we have here the Jacobian matrix, multiplied by the difference between the two arguments, alpha minus, in this order, alpha minus x, plus this vector, matrix by vector. We stop here at the first order term, so we must have a residual remainder term, which is a vector, the vector, the remainder vector of the Taylor's formula, which the analysis analysis says that this vector has a generic entry VR, which depends, as you guess, on the second order partial derivatives of all the function FR. We have, if we count all the derivatives, we have n squared first order partial derivative. The second order partial derivatives are for each f, they are n squared. We have n function f, so we have n cubed second order derivative. In which way they appear here in the formula that we will use for the remainder of the Taylor's formula? Second order term, so 1 over the factorial of the order, 1 over 2. We have the difference between the arguments transposed by H has been already used for other uses. We use the vector S with the index R computed in a vector CR. Who is SR? S sub R is the Hessian, which means the matrix of second order partial derivatives, Hessian matrix of F with the same index. I have not finished here because here I must have the same vector not transposed. Okay. The analogy with the scalar case, in the scalar case you have 1 over 2, this is a number, this by this makes the square of the difference, and here you have only one second order derivative, because in the scalar case I have only one derivative of each order. If we want, we can revert here and here the order of appearance of the two arguments, because we have minus by minus, so it's the same. Can we give some bound to this vector, to its entry, to its entries before or all? Yes, it can be made in various ways. We can proceed by using well-known properties of the norms, which we recorded in the first weeks of the course. Just let us see here as the scalar product of this vector by this other vector. Vector, first factor in the scalar product. The second factor has to be seen as the product of S by this vector. If you remember the Cauchy-Schwarz or Simply-Schwarz inequality for the scalar product, it holds also in the complex case, but let us recede to the real case. We are dealing now with real numbers. It says that if you have two vectors v and z, the modulus of the scalar product of two vectors is less than or equal to the product of the norms, of the Euclidean norms, of the two vectors, v and z. If we apply this to the scalar product seen in this way, we have that the modulus of this number is less than 1/2. The two norm of the first vector by the two norm of the second vector, which is of this S R C R X minus alpha. And now, what can we do? Let us turn to infinity norm. Infinity norm sometimes it is easier to use the two norm. The two norm of a generic vector is less than or equal to the square root of n, that is the size, the dimension of the space of vectors, by the infinity norm. So here I can bound with I will need this relation, but I have no room, so here you we have the square root of n and the infinity norm of the same vector. Here again the square root of n, the infinity norm of the same vector, but the vector which appears here is the product of a matrix by another vector. So we can bound again with the infinity norm of S by the infinity norm of this vector. This point we have infinity norm everywhere. I put all together and I have square root of n over 2. N over 2, the square of the infinity norm of the error at the previous iteration. What is left? The infinity norm of this matrix of second order partial derivatives of f sub r computed in this particular point. Um, This is true for any entry of this vector. So this is true also for the maximum in the modulus. So it is true also for the maximum modulus of V, which is the infinity norm of V. So we have found that the infinity norm of the vector, the remainder vector, for that Taylor's formula, can be bounded by a quadratic term, which is the most important term, by some values which depend on the second order partial derivatives. Now we have to use this bound in, I write it again.
Professor?
Si?
The R subbing S, that remains there, and it's completely, can be any one, it's true for all R.
For all R?
Even when I take the
infinity. No, you're right. If I consider the infinity norm, I have to drop off the R here.
Okay.
With the maximum, I have to use some kind of maximum. What maximum? These are numbers, so here I can write the maximum of R, but if the partial derivatives are continuous, here I can also write maximum over R, but also over S belonging to omega S, the neighborhood I'm using. Here the maximum is made for X in the neighborhood S of the infinity norms of all the norms of all the matrices, the Hessian matrices, S sub R and X. This is another constant which is suitable for this map. Now this code. The use of this bound to gain the final result is the following. I write again. It was like, I need to write again the last, yeah?
We use the maps for the infinity norm. Isn't the infinity norm already the maps?
These matrices depend on X. So, it was simpler to use here the maximum over n numbers without involving the neighborhood S. I could also correctly put here the maximum over R of the infinity norms of the matrices, which are specific matrices, as S index R, C index R. Here I have n matrices, n norms, the maximum of n numbers. If I know that these Hessian matrices, which in general depend on X, a continuous function of X, I can bound more, substituting here X, with X varying in this set. In the final relation, I don't want to see Xi. It is better to have a bound which does not explicitly involve the vector xi which appear in the Taylor form, the Taylor's form. At this point, there is no substantial difference between these two ways to bound of bounding the vector v. The use of the vector v, the norm, the infinity norm of the vector v, the last relation involving all the guys in the scenery was J was this. Difference J plus 1 alpha, and on the other side J if you take into account, it is a substitution, an algebraic method, take into account the Taylor form, right? This term is exactly V. I forgotten enough. Sorry. I forgot. Is this right? Okay. Just give a look to the Taylor formula, which introduces the remainder vector v, and you will see that this is exactly v. So, apply the norm everywhere. Which norm? The infinity norm everywhere. You will have first. Let us again carry the matrix J. As its inverse to the second side, to the left-hand side. So first, I will find this vector equal to the inverse of this, which was colored k, by v. Infinity norms. I leave the last bound. The infinity norm. Is bounded by infinity norm of K the matrix K, the infinity norm of the vector V. But the infinity norm of the vector V is bounded by this. So I put all together, I can write here the final bound, which will be at the end, I write the square of the infinity norm of the previous error multiplied by, I can write here the maximum of the infinity norm of this matrix over the set S. This term. From this. And over 2. And the maximum of the norm. This is the last. Sorry. The maximum over R, but also over S, of S, of the infinity norm of the matrices, the Hessian matrices. Well, this is a complicated expression, but the importance is simply the fact that here I have some constant beta which multiplies the square of the of some norm of the previous error. For by the equivalence of norms, this result that has been obtained for the infinity norm holds also for any vector norm. So I can use the norm which I prefer. There is a final which I will only describe to you a nice result regarding the convex case. It is a nice result because it is analogous to, this is an extension to the multivariate case of the so-called convexity conditions for monotonic convergence of Newton's method in the scalar case. Let me give you just an idea, a scheme of this property, which is hard to detect. So it is nice, but not very useful in the practice. The so-called convexity sufficient conditions. Let us start from the scalar case, which is immediately clear. In the scalar case, I am referring to a situation when the function f, I am, the equation f x equal to 0, is convex and, say, monotonic increasing. From the graphic point of view, I am thinking of an interval S containing the solution. In the interval S, the function is supposed to be increasing and convex. You know that if I start from one point of the interval S, well, say the second extreme, x equal to 0, you will obtain with the Newton method a monotonic decreasing convergent sequence. Formally, always in the scalar case, all this is described by assumptions of this type. Positive first derivative, convexity means non-negative second derivative. The choice of the starting point is connected with the requirement that f in the starting point has the same sign of the second order derivative. So I can write here, I can put also the sign equal. This is well known. These three conditions are collected in some kind of global convergence sufficient condition, which usually are called convexity conditions. In our case, it is much more complicated because we must have a convex function, convex f. What does it mean? Convex f means simply that we have that all its components, the functions f sub f, are convex. So when I take a function from r to the power n to r to the power n, I extend the notion of convexity that you know, starting from the usual definition of convexity for the single components of the function f. So this first requirement, which generalizes this. For the derivative, this condition is replaced in the general case by a subtle condition over the inverse of the Jacobian matrix. Here we have positivity, here we have non-negativity, entry-wise. Entry by entry, this means that the inverse of the Jacobian matrix of the function f, those n to the square, to the n square functions that form this inverse matrix, have no negative values, naturally, in the set S. The set S must be also convex. Restrictive requirements is made here. The set S is a plurirectangle. That is, as the form, the Cartesian product of intervals, closed intervals, A sub I, B sub I. Is, in R to the power 3, it would be a cube. The third, replaces, second replaces, the condition of the first derivative in the scalar case. The last is replaced by, in this case, the non-negativity of, let me see, of the function f also in this case entry-wise computed in the starting point. Una matrice positiva significa positiva non negativa elemento per elemento, vettore non negativo, non negativo elemento per elemento. If all these conditions are satisfied, then entry-wise, then the sequence converges. Monotonically, also in this case, monotonically means entry-wise, componente per componente, with this choice of sign, it is like in this case, in the scalar case, so I will have a decreasing okay, this is the analogous of the convexity conditions for the scalar case, why it is hard to check, to expect, to apply this condition. Because not only I must have a convex function, but here I have a strong condition of the inverse of the Jacobian matrix, this condition is, it is hard to and also the last condition, I must start from an initial point where the function has all the components not negative. Here you will find example. I guess that in the integrative lesson of today's afternoon, I say we showed you some example of situation of this kind. Tomorrow, Professor Bigi will show you some uses of the Newton methods for minimization problems. Next week, I will come back, and in the next four, I guess, lesson, we will analyze least squares method, which is another topic which is at the boundary between linear algebra, numerical analysis, and optimization. Okay, ci fermiamo.